Chapter 11. Education of the Middle Ages. The development of the papacy led directly to the Dark Ages, for the noontide of the papacy was the world's moral midnight. The papacy was the logical working out of an educational scheme, hence the moral darkness which spread over the world during the prophetic period of 1260 years was due to wrong methods of education. People do not sink into degradation and sin when properly educated. Truth elevates, and when embodied in man, brings him nearer to his Maker. Faith is the ladder by which he climbs, and when that element has been lacking in an educational system, the masses have sunk lower and lower. Mind is a wonderful thing, the most profound study of the universe. It was designed to be free, to grasp the mighty laws of its own Creator, and a means was supplied by which that very thing could be done. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, but let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. In order to maintain the supremacy thus gained, it was necessary for the education of the young to lie wholly within the control of the papal hierarchy. And it is with their educational institutions and educational methods that we have now to deal. It is hoped that the study of the Dark Ages will so accentuate the importance of Protestants maintaining their own schools that the tendency now so strong in the other direction may receive a check. The education begun in the schools of the early Christians has been followed into the monastic institutions of the Middle Ages. The life and power of Christianity departed, and form alone remained. It has been said that paganism in the garb of Christianity walked into the church, and it can truthfully be added that it gained admittance through the schools. In order to trace carefully the education offered by the papacy, and that comprised all that was then offered, the first quotations are concerning primary instruction. Laurie says, "Instruction began about the age of 7. The alphabet, written on tables or leaves, was learned by heart by the children, then syllables and words. The first reading book was the Latin Psalter, and this was read again and again until it could be said by heart. And numerous priests and even monks were content all their lives with the mere sound of Latin words, which they could both read and recite, but did not understand." Note carefully that work for these children was almost wholly memory work. They were to learn by heart and to repeat without understanding. This was the first step in that great system which binds the minds of the masses to the will of one sovereign mind. Writing followed. The elements of arithmetic were also taught, but merely with a view to the calculation of church days and festivals. Latin was begun very early, apparently immediately after the Psaltery was known, with the learning by heart of declensions and conjugations and lists of vocables. The rule was to use Latin in the school in conversing. In the 11th century, if not earlier, Latin conversation books were not only read, but, like everything else, learned by heart. Their method of studying Latin emphasizes the thought of the formal, abstract way of teaching, which tended to conservatism and mental subjection. Memory is the faculty that subordinates the present under the past, and its extensive training develops a habit of mind that holds by what is prescribed and recoils from the new and untried. In short, the educational curriculum that lays great stress on memorizing produces a class of conservative people. The papal schools employed methods which, in themselves, in the course of a few generations, would develop dependent rather than independent thinking, Therefore, methods are as important as the subject taught. Again, it is well to remember that there was a deep design in making the Latin tongue universal. It was one of the ways by which the papacy kept its control of all nations and tongues. Draper explains it thus: "The unity of the Church, and therefore its power, required the use of Latin as a sacred language. Through this, Rome had stood in an attitude strictly European, and was enabled to maintain a general international relation. It gave her far more power than her asserted celestial authority. Their officials could pass without difficulty into every nation and communicate without embarrassment with each other, from Ireland to Bohemia, from Italy to Scotland. The character of the youth was formed," says Painter, "from memorizing the fables of Aesop and collections of maxims and proverbs." After this, Virgil was usually the textbook and was handled in the same style. Of the monastic schools, Mosheim says, "In most of the schools, the so-called seven liberal arts were taught. The pupil commenced with grammar, then proceeded to rhetoric, and afterward to logic or dialectics. Having thus mastered the trivium, as it was called, those who aspired to greater attainments proceeded with slow steps through the quadrivium, a course including arithmetic, music, geometry, and astronomy, to the honor of perfectly learned men." Says Painter, "7 years were devoted to the completion of the course in liberal arts, the trivium and the quadrivium. Dialectic or logic was based somewhat remotely on the writings of Aristotle. At a later period, logic was rigidly applied to the development of theology and gave rise to a class of scholars called the schoolmen. Arithmetic was imperfectly taught, importance being attached to the supposed secret properties of numbers. Geometry was taught in an abridged form, while astronomy did not differ materially from astrology. The study of music consisted chiefly in learning to chant the hymns of the church." Mosheim thus continues his description of the work of the schools in the 11th century. "This course of study, adopted in all the schools of the West, was not a little changed after the middle of this century. For logic, having been improved by the reflection and skill of certain close thinkers, and being taught more fully and acutely, acquired such an ascendancy in the minds of the majority that they neglected grammar, rhetoric, and other sciences, both the elegant and the abstruse, and devoted their whole lives to dialectics or to logical and metaphysical discussions. For whoever was well acquainted with dialectics, or what we call logic and metaphysics, was supposed to possess learning enough and to lose nothing by being ignorant of all other branches of learning. In this age, the philosophy of the Latins was confined wholly to what they called dialectics, and the other branches of philosophy were unknown even by name. Moreover, their dialectics was miserably dry and barren." This is sufficient, perhaps, on the use of language and logic, and we turn to geography and some of the sciences. Even the children today will smile at the teachings of some of the Church Fathers on the subject of geography. Says Draper, "In the patristic geography, the earth is a flat surface bordered by the waters of the sea, on the yielding support of which rests the crystalline dome of the sky. These doctrines were for the most part supported by passages from the Holy Scriptures, perversely wrested from their proper meaning. Thus Cosmas Indico Pleustis, whose patristic geography had been an authority for nearly 800 years, triumphantly disposed of the sphericity of the earth by demanding of its advocates how, in the day of judgment, men on the other side of a globe could see the Lord descending through the air. It was in opposition to such theories and 100 absurdities concerning the ocean, the boiling waters of the equator, the serpents in the west, etc., that Columbus, Da Gama, and other explorers had to contend. And one of the most wonderful effects of the work of these navigators was the thrust given papal education. A wound was then received, which was incurable. If, in the mind of the reader, the question arises, why should the papal schools teach such things? Simply consider that the whole system of papal theology was intended to make the people feel that the world was the center of the universe and that the Pope was the center of the world. Christ and his position in creation were usurped by the head of the church. This was the papacy. This could be brought about only by education, and could be maintained only as generation after generation was taught from infancy to old age to place faith in man, not God. Not only the subjects taught, but the manner of teaching them served well the purpose of the papacy. Only within the last few years, comparatively speaking, have our own schools seen the necessity of breaking away from some of those relics of the educational system of the Dark Ages. Memory work, pure and simple, has given way in a great measure to research and experiment, even in the primary grades. The alphabet is no longer driven into the childish mind by the ferule, nor kept there by mere force of repetition. The advanced methods in dealing with the mind are a step in the right direction. The pity is that educators, while groping for light, while casting off some of the moth-eaten garments of past ages, have failed to see the cause of the evil and deal so largely with results instead of removing the cause. The evil began by renouncing the scriptures and faith in Holy Writ as a part of education. The spirit and power will accompany reform only when these are replaced in their proper setting. While educators of the world are realizing the need of a change in methods, it is time for them to see also the need of a change in subject matter and textbooks. Protestants in particular should arouse to the times. If the study of paganism, instead of Christianity or truth, produced the Dark Ages, and if wrong methods held the minds of men and prolonged that darkness, forbidding the shining of the light, it is time for both methods and material to be reconstructed in the schools of today. We can with profit notice the attitude of the papal schools toward some of the sciences, taking, for example, that most practical of modern branches, the science of medicine. What was the work of the physician during the Dark Ages? Draper says, "Physicians were viewed by the church with dislike and regarded as atheists by the people, who held firmly to the lessons they had been taught that cures must be wrought by relics of martyrs and bones of saints, by prayers and intercessions." It is well to remember that Christ was the great physician, healing not only soul maladies, but physical infirmities as well, and to the apostles was given the commission to heal the sick and restore sight to the blind. Gradually, however, as the power of the gospel in its purity was lost by the substitution of error for truth, the leaders of the church introduced miracle cures and preached the efficacy of the bones of saints, etc., in the cure of disease. This became popular and increased throughout the Dark Ages. Draper describes the fanaticism of the monastic schools and finally assigns a reason for the exclusion from them of the study of physiology and anatomy and the science of medicine. The body, he says, was under some spiritual charge, the first joint of the right thumb being in the care of God the Father, the second under that of the Blessed Virgin, and so on of other parts. For each disease, there was a saint. A man with sore eyes must invoke Saint Clara. But if it were an inflammation elsewhere, he must turn to Saint Anthony. For the propitiation of these celestial beings, it was necessary that fees should be paid, and thus the practice of imposture. Medicine became a great source of profit. In all this, there was no other intention than that of extracting money. While such was the teachings of the papacy, the Jews and Mohammedans were achieving wonderful success and making discoveries of lasting benefit to mankind in Spain and Asia Minor. Bishops, princes, kings, and popes had each in private his Hebrew doctor, though all understood that he was a contraband luxury, in many countries pointedly and absolutely prohibited by the law. In the 11th century, nearly all the physicians in Europe were Jews. One reason for this was the church would tolerate no interference with her spiritual methods of treating disease, which formed one of her most productive sources of gain, and the study of medicine had been formally introduced into the rabbinical schools. The bitter hatred of the papacy toward independence of mind is well illustrated in the treatment that the Jewish physicians received from the popes. Draper says, "The school at Salerno was still sending forth its doctors. In Rome, Jewish physicians were numerous, the popes themselves employing them. At this period, Spain and France were full of learned Jews, and perhaps partly by their exerting too much influence upon the higher classes with whom they came in contact, for the physician of a Christian prince was very often the rival of his confessor, and partly because the practice of medicine, as they pursued it, interfered with the gains of the church, the clergy took alarm and caused to be reenacted or enforced the ancient laws. The Council of Béziers, A.D. 1246, and the Council of Albi, A.D. 1254, prohibited all Christians from resorting to the services of an Israelitish physician." To show that this was a matter which concerned the schools, and in proof of the statement that papal schools still adhere to formalism, miracle cure, and relic worship, we need only to notice that the faculty of Paris University, awakening at last to the danger of the case, caused, A.D. 1301, a decree to be published prohibiting either man or woman of the religion of Moses from practicing medicine upon any person of the Catholic religion. A similar course was pursued in Spain. At this time, the Jews were confessedly at the head of French medicine. It was the appointment of one of their persuasion, Profetius, as regent of the faculty of Montpellier, A.D. 1300, which drew upon them the wrath of the faculty of Paris. The animosity of the French ecclesiastics against the Jewish physicians at last led to the banishment of all the Jews from France, A.D. 1306. The papal universities were unwilling to teach medicine, and finding that the Jewish schools of science were greatly weakening papal authority in France, this race was banished bodily. Comparing this history with the present work of the medical fraternity, and especially with that class of medical students whose life work is to spread the gospel while relieving the body, one better understands that physiology should be the basis of every educational effort, and the place that it and kindred sciences should occupy in the courses of instruction pursued by our children, youth, and maturer minds, and also the cause of that spiritual darkness which is even now hanging over the world and for centuries held Europe in its clutches, but it shall be pierced by Christian education. The papacy, in case of opposition which threatened her authority, had two methods of procedure. The first was an attempt to annihilate both the trouble and the troublers. Thus she simply banished all Jews from France that her own universities might not be overshadowed by the light of truth. Her second method of procedure was a counter-reformation, that is, if a reform in education arose outside the church which threatened to undermine her doctrines, it might be met by a partial reform within her borders, the reform going only so far as was absolutely necessary to satisfy the cravings of minds that dared think for themselves. It was not always possible to completely crush a Reformation or the Reformers, and, as was quite often the case in the schools, studies which could not be entirely banished were taught, but in such a way as best to conserve the needs of the Church. That medicine as well as law was taught in the higher papal schools cannot be denied. Says Mosheim, "The seven liberal arts, the trivium and the quadrivium, were gradually included under the term philosophy, to which were added theology, jurisprudence, and medicine. And thus these four faculties, as they are called, were in the next century formed in the universities. But in the study of medicine, as in philosophy or law, memory work devoid of understanding, the form without the spirit, was the characteristic. As the saints and martyrs in theology had taken the place of the Greek gods and goddesses, so in the study of other branches, a multitude of pagan terms, clothed with what was then known as the Christian spirit, was made to satisfy the longing for real mental culture. The simplicity of the gospel was laid aside. What God had revealed was made to appear too complex for the human mind, and the secret things which are known only to God were pried into. In theology, dialectics or logic became the study of endless queries, difficult syllogisms, meaningless quibbles. Men delighted in propounding such questions as, "How many angels can stand on the point of a needle?" And other prided themselves in the acuteness of their reasoning powers in arguing such questions. Likewise, in medicine, the study of the simple needs of the body and the rational treatment of disease was obscured by hundreds of Latin terms, and these were memorized to the neglect of the simple philosophy of the science. It is with this multitude of names, hoary with age, and savoring strongly of their pagan origin, that the student of medicine is still compelled to grapple. The history of the rise of European universities throws light on the attitude of the papacy toward education. While Europe was overspread by spiritual and intellectual darkness, God used another people to disseminate truth. When faith in God was lost, and in its place was substituted that blind faith in man and obedience to the church which is known in European history as the Age of Faith, learning was propagated by the Arabs. That power which had failed to conquer the world by the sword now gained by intellectual culture what the arms of Muhammad and his immediate successors failed to achieve. Spain, while in the hands of the Moors, contributed more to European civilization than at any other time in her history, and it was as an educator and through the influence of her schools that the papacy received its blow from the south, which made her more readily succumb to the revolt of Germany under Luther. By the Arabs, flourishing schools were established in all the principal cities, notably at Baghdad and Damascus in the east, and at Cordova, Salamanca, and Toledo in the west. Here, grammar, mathematics, astronomy, philosophy, chemistry, and medicine were pursued with great ardor and success. The Arabians originated chemistry, discovering alcohol and nitric and sulfuric acids. They gave algebra and trigonometry their modern form, applied the pendulum to the reckoning of time, ascertained the size of the earth by measuring a degree, and made catalogs of the stars. And all this was done when Europe as a whole was lying in darkness, when the chemist was considered a wizard, when astronomy was merely astrology, and whatever learning existed was formal and spiritless. But the discoveries of the Arab teachers could not long remain with them alone, and it is with the spread of their ideas through the schools by means of the students that we are concerned. For a time, they, the Arabs, were the intellectual leaders of Europe. Their schools in Spain were largely attended by Christian youth from other European countries, who carried back with them to their homes the Arabian science, and through it stimulated intellectual activity in Christian papal nations. The specialization of studies such as theology, medicine, or philosophy, together with the impulse derived from the Mohammedans in Africa and the Arabs in Spain, led to the establishment of the universities, which were, as before stated, composed of four faculties or colleges. They arose independently of both church and state. The University of Paris became the most distinguished seat of learning in Europe. At one time, it was attended by more than 20,000 students. The growth of the universities was very rapid, and they threatened speedily to revolutionize the society of Europe and overthrow the papal hierarchy. The influence and power of the universities were speedily recognized, says Painter, and though originally free associations, they were soon brought into relation with the church and the state by which they were officially authorized and endowed. If learning could not be suppressed, then it must be controlled by the church, and the church sought to attach them, the universities, to itself, in order to join to the power of faith, the power of knowledge. The first privileges that the universities received proceeded from the popes. While Rome was not the mother, she was yet the nurse of universities. Scientific investigation had by this time received such an impulse from youth who had been students in the Arab schools that the church could not hope to crush it. The only hope of the papacy was to so surround the truth with fables and mysteries, and to so conduct the schools that again the spirit of progress would be lost in its labyrinthine wanderings through empty forms. Monopoly in education works havoc in the same way that a monopoly in commerce leads to oppression. And so it was. The students led a free and uncontrolled life, seeking and finding protection in their own university authorities, even from the civil power. Youth from the age of 12 and upward attended these universities, making it necessary to teach the secondary studies which terminated in a bachelor's degree. Boys attended the Parisian university merely for instruction in grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic, and after 3 or 4 years' study, they received the title of baccalaureus. When he reached the age of 17 or 18, he then began the study for the mastership. It will be remembered that the schools established by the early church were marked for the simplicity of their methods and their singleness of purpose. Their object was to educate workers for the spread of the gospel. For the accomplishment of this object, the course of instruction was arranged, and students were sent forth into the world commissioned of God, as were the disciples after their ordination. There was no call for the granting of degrees. These, it is true, were used in the pagan schools and indicated that the receiver had been initiated after years of study into the hidden mysteries of Greek wisdom. Among the pagans, indeed, the principle of degrees and diplomas dated back to the days of Egyptian and Babylonian supremacy, where it was indicative of fellowship in the grossest forms of licentiousness. Greece, the country which united the learning of Babylon and the wisdom of Egypt, and offered it to Europe in the form of Platonism, naturally enough made use of diplomas and degrees. and the fact that her wisdom was so complicated in its nature made it necessary to spend long years in mastering her sciences. Paganism, moreover, was but one model for all men. Its aim is ever to crush individuality and mold all characters alike. To accomplish this purpose, the schools arranged their studies in courses, demanding that each student should pass over the same ground. This is characteristic of all educational systems aside from that one, the true education, which comes from God. If you look to China, you find it there as it develops the disciples of Confucius. India educates her Brahmins in the same manner. The priests and wise men of Egypt were taught in schools of a similar type. The Jews had aped the fashion of the pagan world, and it was from this custom that Christ called his disciples. One of the surest signs that the schools established in the days of Christian purity had lost the spirit which characterized the apostolic teaching is the fact that the schools of the Middle Ages had adopted this pagan custom. Students were called into the universities when mere boys, and by hundreds and thousands were run through the grind which we term course of instruction, and were turned out at the end of 10, 20, and sometimes even 40 years with a degree which, in dignity, corresponded to the years spent in completing the course. This custom is papal. It is opposed to the very spirit of Christianity, and any institution of learning which deigns to accept the approval of the state, while at the same time passing as a Christian institution, is not only linking itself with the papacy, but with paganism as well. Of his followers, Christ says, "They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world." Older students, those especially in the theological faculty with their 15 or 16 years course of study, achieved in this respect far greater notoriety. At the age of 30 or 40, the student at the university was still a scholar. The idea of long courses is not, then, a modern one, and American colleges can truthfully point to the University of Paris for the precedent in this respect as in some others. In the granting of degrees, another interesting subject is approached. Laurie continues. Up to the middle of the 12th century, anyone taught in the infant universities who thought he had the requisite knowledge. In the second half of the 12th century, when bishops and abbots, who acted personally or through their deputies as chancellors of the rising university schools, wished to assume to themselves exclusively the right of granting the license, Pope Alexander III forbade them on the ground that the teaching faculty was a gift of God. This, however, must have been the work of a liberal pope, for earlier, that is, in 1219, Pope Honorius III interfered with the granting of degrees, and in order to impose a check on abuses, directed that they should be conferred not by, but by permission of, the archdeacon of the cathedral and under his presidency. The church had gained control of the universities, and through her representative, usually the chancellor, granted degrees. Now, in order to keep the authority well in her own hands, no one was allowed to teach who did not hold a license granted by the university after an examination. Thus the educational trust developed, and the iron hand of Rome, though concealed in a silken glove, clenched her victories and strove to crush all opponents. Our modern B.S., M.A., L.L.D., D.D., etc. were adopted into the universities at this stage of educational history. Itter informs us, says Laurie, that a complete university course was represented by 4 degrees, bachelor, master, licentiate, and finally doctor, which last was usually taken at the age of 30 or 35. The next development of the degree system was the introduction of the grades of bachelor and master, or licentiate, into each of the higher faculties, theology, law, and medicine. Thus, a man who had finished his preliminary art studies, generally at the age of 21, and wished to specialize in theology, medicine, or law, had to pass through the stages of bachelor of theology, or of medicine, or of law, and then of master or licentiate before he obtained the title of doctor. The bachelorship of medicine or law was reached in 3 years, of theology in 7. 4 years further study brought the doctor's degree. The conferring of degrees was originated by a pope. The educational monopoly appeared quite complete, and having gained the form of godliness and the civil power, the old scheme of killing the life and substituting those things which would recognize the papal hierarchy were again introduced. Leading educators were awakening to the true situation Christian education alone can deliver. The moral tone of the universities was low, says Painter. There were brawls, outbreaks, and abominable immoralities. The students, say the Vienna statutes, shall not spend more time in drinking, fighting, and guitar playing than at physics, logic, and the regular courses of lectures, and they shall not get up public dances in the streets. Quarrelers, wanton persons, drunkards, those that go about serenading at night, or who spend their leisure in following after lewd women, thieves, those that insult citizens, players at dice, having been properly warned and not reforming, besides the ordinary punishment provided by law for those misdemeanors, shall be deprived of their academical privileges and expelled. These prohibitions give us a clear insight into university life of the time, for it was not worse at Vienna than at Paris and elsewhere. Could some of those medieval students be resurrected and placed in some of the universities of the 19th century, they might feel quite at home, not only as far as courses of study and the granting of degrees is concerned, but in revelings, parties, etc., judging from the reports of the hazing, drinking, and general carousing of the students in our university towns. The conduct of students is the reflex of the instruction given. It is not, therefore, to be wondered at that the instruction of the universities, containing as it did the form without the life, should fail to develop stability of character in its students. The true Catholic attitude to all investigation was and is one admitting of great advances in every department of learning while checking all true freedom of thought. The North American Review for October 1842 expresses in concise language the relation of students and schools to the general government and consequent state of society. It says, "In the colleges is determined the character of most of the persons who are to fill the professions, teach the schools, write the books, and do most of the business of legislation for the whole body of the people. The general direction of literature and politics, the prevailing habits and modes of thought throughout the country, are in the hands of men whose social position and early advantages have given them an influence of the magnitude and permanency of which the possessors themselves are hardly conscious." Recognizing this fact, the papacy controlled the education of the Middle Ages and is today seeking to do the same thing. Luther and other reformers, also recognizing this fact, sought to overthrow the tyranny of the papacy by establishing new schools where freedom of thought would be fostered through faith in God's Word. Protestants today, looking upon the system of education as it now exists, and tracing there the same long courses in the classics and the sciences, the same degrees granted in a manner similar to the Dark Ages, the textbook containing the same theories, the same terms, the same doctrines of philosophy, the same tendency toward monarchism, or the monopoly of education by certain universities, and through them by the same power that has borne sway, should, for the sake of their government and for the sake of their faith, establish schools of their own. As the papacy, by the subjection of thought, builds up a monarchy in place of democracy, as she in the same way overthrows faith in God, substituting faith in man or the church, so Protestant schools should educate children in the pure principles of that gospel freedom which recognizes the equality of every man in the sight of heaven and makes it possible for the government to be of, for, and by the people by developing the Christian character through faith in Jesus Christ.